It's one modular exponentiation, which is about 0.1 seconds on a modern processor. It's still several seconds on an old PDA, so you might not be able to do it every message if you have, if messages are going faster than that. But even in an instant message-like application, one message every few seconds is pushing the bounds of reasonable. So you might not want to change the key every single message, but maybe every 5 or 10 messages or something like this. Not really. I almost always find it preferable to use Elgamal and Diffie-Hellman. There are some other technical advantages, like RSA encryption is cheaper than Elgamal encryption, because you only have to do basically a couple of modular multiplications to do cubing mod a number, right? And RSA encryption is just raising to this tiny exponent 3, or 65537, or something really small, whereas Elgamal encryption involves raising to a much larger exponent. There's a question here? No? Okay. So there are trade-offs between whether encryption and or decryption speed is important to you and whether key generation time is important to you. So as always, you have to look at your application. Okay, what else? There's also the cost of distributing the new keys, right? So if you remember, your public encryption key, everyone's supposed to have a copy of, right? So what, now once a second you're publishing a new key? That's not going to work really well. Not to mention that the MIT key server is going to get full real fast, right? So that's another thing to take into account. And you also might have to keep track of some old ones in order to read a message. Say a message takes a long time in transit, right? You might want to read it. But, okay, so the two things. Distributing new keys is straightforward. Basically, any time I send you a message, I attach to it a copy of my current encryption key, the key you should use to send me the next message you send me. If I send you a different message and I've changed my key, I'll send you a different public key. But let's say you sent me a message and I've changed my key and I'm sending you my new key and they cross, I need to have that old key lying around in order to read it. You can't keep old keys too long though, for obvious reasons, right? Because if you keep an old key too long, then a compromise will expose all the messages encrypted with those old keys. So there's a trade-off. Turns out that just keeping the current key and the previous key is usually enough. That will handle messages crossing in transit. And if you change your keys with a certain pattern, which I'll talk about in a bit, then unless you have major message reordering, which doesn't happen that often. So the question is, but that means that as soon as I get the current key, then when Bob sends his next key with his next message, you'll be able to read it. And that's not quite right, because Bob doesn't send his private key, he sends his public key. If you have Bob's current private key, then the next message that goes by, he's sending his new public key, and in a couple of seconds, he's going to forget his old private key. So now you know no secret information of Bob's, but you know his new public key. But that's okay. Everyone's allowed to know the public key. The question is, isn't this method vulnerable to denial of service? And the answer is it's exactly as vulnerable as the communication itself, right? So the point is, if you miss a message, you won't know the future public key, and in a moment, you'll see why, how we get around that. We assume that messages might be droppable. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, the repository that stores everyone's public keys basically has a problem, right? The short answer is, we basically do away with the repository storing the encryption keys. And you'll see how in just a minute. I think I'll finish answering that question after I show you how changing your keys works. So, basically these are the steps you use for updating your keys. For every person you're actively communicating with, and by actively I mean something like you're in an instant message chat and you're having an active conversation. Once you're done and you stop talking to him, you can forget all your keys, and if you want to start talking with him again, you restart the protocol. Okay? So, for everyone you're having an active conversation with, and this is the same, if you're familiar with cryptography, just think of this as what you would ordinarily use a session key for. Right? Instead of storing just a session key, this is what you store. You store his current encryption key for you, his public key, your current key pair for him, and your previous key pair for him. And you'll note here that what I mean by his key for you is that for every person you're communicating with, you keep a separate encryption key pair. This is why we don't have a repository of encryption key pairs anymore, because there is not one public key that you use. If there was, then if that was compromised, it would reveal a lot of information. So anyone that wants to communicate with you has to contact you, and this is the startup phase, contacts you and gets your current public key for him, which you will generate on the fly. Okay? So whenever you send a message, you use your current idea of his encryption locking key to lock it, and you include a copy of your current locking key so he knows how to respond. When you receive a message, then it's either a message encrypted with a really old key, in which case, oh well, you can't read it at all. Or it's encrypted with your previous key, or it's encrypted with your current key. If it's encrypted with your current key, that means, obviously, that the guy that sent you the message knows your current key. Which means you don't care about your previous key anymore, because he's already on your current key. So that's the point at which you make a new key. So anytime you receive a message that shows that the guy you're communicating with has received and is now using your current key, that's when you make a new key. If you never send him a message, so if you have an unbalanced communication where one person's sending a lot and this guy sends rarely, then the same key does get used a lot. You can slightly mitigate this by if your application does have this feature of a lot of messages tend to be sent this way, then just send acknowledgments occasionally that cause the keys to change. Okay, and when you receive a message, you can just read this. You forget your old key pair, you change your current key pair to your old key pair, and you make a new current key pair. And his message will include his current encryption key, which might be different from the last idea you knew from him. It might have changed in the meantime. And just store that as here, what your idea of his encryption key is. Yep. The question is, what's the advantage of this over simply deleting messages? The problem is, you don't know that even Carl have deleted the messages. If Carnivore has been recording all of the messages that have been going to you, they'll keep it for years, right? And you have no way to delete that information. So you need to delete all copies of the keys so that any copies of the encrypted messages are useless. I'll get to authentication in a bit. Is there a question out there? Okay. So, one more detail. This is technical cryptographic detail. The usual thing that you do in public key cryptography, we do here too. You don't actually take the message and encrypt it with public key cryptography. You, by encrypt with the current locking key, we really mean use Diffie-Hellman to combine your and his encryption keys to produce a shared secret. If you're not familiar with Diffie-Hellman, it's basically a way to take two people's public keys and combine them in a way that if you know either of the private keys, you can determine a certain value, which will be the same regardless of which private key you know. But if you know neither of the private keys, then you can't determine that value. Okay? So that's a really cool cryptographic technique, and this forms one of the really cool ways to do perfect forward secrecy. So you produce a shared secret that way, and then you use that shared secret to encrypt the message using a regular symmetric cipher like AES, right? And the reason you do that is that public key crypto is slow and AES is fast, so for a big message, it's easier to use public key crypto only to generate one small number and then use that to encrypt a large message. As long as you can derive a shared secret, it should work fine. You have to be careful with RSA because you have to somehow still get the perfect forward secrecy aspect. So if you're using RSA, you have to change your RSA keys a lot. It's still doable. That's not how we chose to implement it. But if you're... Yeah, if you change your RSA keys sufficiently often, then you can get perfect forward secrecy that way. So the question is, can you expand this to more than a two-party communication? The easiest way to do that is by doing an obvious extension of this to do that is by just having a flood algorithm with a tree structure. Use a minimum spanning tree and a flood algorithm, and each hop is encrypted just with two-party communication. There are variants of Diffie-Hellman that work with multiple keys, and you could do it that way as well. Okay, and the other benefit is the resulting shared secret changes every time either party changes his encryption key. And this will be really useful to us later. Okay. So, now we move on to the next piece, message integrity. So we're moving away from confidentiality, which is achieved by perfect forward secrecy, onto integrity. So the question is, what if Carl performs an attack where he knows Bob's current key and he somehow prevents Bob from realizing that Alice knows his current key and thus Bob never changes his key? The only way for Bob to not know that Alice knows his current key is if Bob never receives any messages from Alice. So it becomes simply a denial of service attack, and if Bob never receives any messages from Alice, then the fact that Carl knows his decryption key is useless, because there's no messages to decrypt. Carl wouldn't be able to make Alice's messages look like the old key, right? Alice would only be encrypting messages to the old key if she never received any messages from Bob, right? Because every one of Bob's messages would contain his new key. Okay, message integrity. So we want to arrange the following situation. Bob receives a message purportedly from Alice. Bob needs to be assured that the message actually came from Alice and hasn't been modified. Same setup as for digital signatures. But no one, not even Bob, can assure anyone else of this fact. Okay? If anyone tries to check whether Alice sent this message, they have no idea. If Bob tries to show someone, I got this message from Alice, they have no reason to believe him. Right? He could have just made up that message himself, which is not the case with digital signatures. The message is digitally signed, then anyone can check that the message was in fact sent by Alice. So we need to do something different. How do we arrange this? So here's the main useful observation. We arrange that the messages are cryptographically authenticated using a key known to both Alice and Bob. Right? A digital signature is authenticated using a key known only to Alice. So if the authentication checks out, then Alice must have been the one that sent it. If we change the situation that it's authenticated using a key known to both Alice and Bob and no one else, then Bob knows that since he didn't write the message, Alice must have. But anyone else doesn't know that Bob didn't write the message. Bob could have written the message. So if Bob shows the message to anyone else, he could have written it. Right? This is the cute trick. This is called a message authentication code, or MAC. And I think it's cooler than digital signatures, but certainly much less widely deployed. So it's a linear increase, a constant factor increase over already sharing a session key with multiple people. In fact, you don't have to, no, it's no increase, right? As if you're already storing session keys with multiple people you're communicating with, then this MAC key can just be, in fact, I'll talk about that next slide, can just be derived from that session key. So, yeah. So a MAC is to a public key digital signature what a symmetric encryption is to public key encryption, right? And the reason I say that is a MAC uses the same key to authenticate and to verify the signature, whereas a digital signature uses a different key to authenticate and verify, in the same way that a symmetric encryption uses the same key to encrypt and decrypt, and public key encryption uses a different key to encrypt and decrypt. Okay? So the way a MAC works is Alice and Bob share a MAC key. There's some shared key. This isn't the same as the shared encryption key, just like you don't want to use the same key for public key encryption and digital signatures, you don't want to use the same key for encryption and for symmetric encryption and MACing, but it can be related. It can be a related key. And we'll see how to relate it later. This key is used both for creating the authenticator, which is called the tag, as well as for checking it. So the way that you do a MAC is you have a message, you know a key, you use the key and the message and you hash it together and you get some authenticator called the tag. To check it, basically Bob, when he receives the message and the tag, he just takes the same key, the same message, creates the tag and checks that the tag's the same. Right? Straightforward. But no one except Alice and Bob can forge authentic looking messages. Right? Because no one else knows that key. So if anyone else tries to create a tag, Bob, when he creates his copy of the tag, it won't match. In fact, no one else can even check that a message is authentic. Because you need to know the key in order to check it. Okay. Repudiability. This is how we handle snitches. So if Bob is a snitch, certainly he can tell everything he knows to Trent, right? So we can't prevent the information from getting out. What we can prevent is Trent having any assurance that that information is accurate, right? We want to make it the case that Trent has to trust that Bob is doing the right thing, right? If Bob's cooperating with the FBI, well, there's only so much Alice can do, right? But we want there not to be some proof that Alice wrote this message. If Carl's owning Bob's computer at the time, then, as we said before, all bets are off during that time, right? We want to, that's not actually true. If Carl owns Bob's computer, he can't make a message look like it came from Alice. Oh, yes. No, you're right. But, yeah, anything that happens while Bob's computer is compromised, we can't prevent, right? Okay. So, the method of using a Mac prevents Bob from convincingly snitching on Alice, right? Because any transcript that he might show to Trent, he could have made up completely. What about Carl? Let's say Carl steals Bob's keys and records a transcript of the encrypted conversation, right? Surely, he can read the communication. He has the keys, he has the encrypted data, he can read it. Nothing we can do about that. We can still try to prevent him from being able to show the transcript to Trent and being able to prove anything about it. Okay? So we use the same trick as before. Now we want to make sure that it's extremely clear that Carl knows the Mac key. Right? Because if Carl knows the Mac key, then Trent has to trust that Carl didn't completely forge this transcript. If Carl didn't know the Mac key, then there would be this hurdle of logic that would have to be made. So what we do is we calculate the Mac key. Remember, I said it shouldn't be the same as the encryption key, but it can be related. We calculate the Mac by taking a simple one-way hash function of the encryption key. So we derive the encryption key using Diffie-Hellman, using this mathematical way of combining the public encryption keys to get the shared secret. The shared secret we use as the AES encryption key. Then we hash that and use that as the Mac key. And the result is that anyone that can read a message can automatically forge the message. Okay? So if you can read it in any way, if no matter how you got your hands on the encryption key, which is the same as the decryption key, you can automatically forge the message. So anyone that hands you a transcript of the message, of the conversation, could have forged. Right. So the first message that's exchanged is basically the original public keys, and there I use the fact that Alice and Bob, remember way back at the beginning I said we're going to grant that Alice and Bob have some way to authenticate each other's keys, and you verify a signature key pair on the phone, and then you can sign that the original Diffie-Hellman communication. Just with your normal signed Diffie-Hellman. And that doesn't break any of the repudiability properties because the information that is signed strictly consists of a key, a public key, and no data. Well, because the signature is only on the first message, so then if the adversary changes subsequent messages, you still want to be able to detect that fact. Right, so the point is you might have to have a single public key out there that does not change. And that's correct, but that's a signature key and not an encryption key. No information is protected by that key. And if a signature key becomes compromised, then changing it has no adverse effect on past communication, which is very important. And we have to speed along a little here, so I can take that up a bit, a little later. Okay. So, again, we just make the MAC key a hash of the encryption key, so anyone that can read the conversation can forge it. So what about Eve? Eve doesn't break into anybody's computer. Eve is just carnivore, can just record a lot of data. So Eve records a transcript of the conversation, but can't necessarily read it. Okay? Most crypto systems are what's called non-malleable. This is another one of the things that you read applied crypto, you really want when you design a crypto system, non-malleability. What non-malleability means is you want it to be hard to take an encrypted message that you don't have the key to and modify it in such a way that the decryption still makes sense. Right? And most crypto systems have something like this property. But if Eve captures a transcript in a non-malleable system, so that if she doesn't know the key, she can't modify it so that decrypting it makes any sense. If Carl separately comes up with the decryption key, then it's pretty clear that if that decryption key decrypts the transcript to something sensible, then that transcript must be accurate, because Eve couldn't have modified it, right? So we need it to be the case that Eve can alter a transcript even if she doesn't know Bob's secrets. Okay? She has to be able to take a transcript and modify it so that the decryption is still makes sense, but is not in fact what Alice said, even if she knows no secrets at all. How do we do that? We use what's called malleable encryption. The opposite of non-malleable. We want to make it as easy as possible for Eve to sensibly alter the transcripts, even if she can't decrypt them. The easiest way to do this is just use any of the XOR styles of encryption. You can either take a block cipher and use a mode like OFB or CTR. CTR is my new favorite mode. It's just so cool. Or use any stream cipher. All stream ciphers work like this. And the way all of these systems work is you take the key and you do some operations on the key and that outputs a series of bytes called the pad. And then you just take the clear text message and you XOR it with the pad and that's the ciphertext. And to decrypt, you just take the same key, you generate the same sequence of bytes, you XOR that again and the pads cancel out and you get the clear text. Right? So, the benefit to the person who's trying to modify a message is to change the transcript. All you have to do is flip some bits of the ciphertext. And if you flip a bit of a ciphertext in one of these systems, all it does is flip that exact bit of the plain text. And there's no other change. So this is as easy as it gets if you can't read the message. In addition, if you know part of the message because of known message structure, headers, whatever, it's certainly trivial to change that part, right? You can make that part say whatever you want. But wait, what about the MAC, right? If you're Eve, so if you know some structure to the message or anything like that, then flipping individual bits will flip the corresponding bits of the output. And it's much easier to do that than it is if you have some strong non-malleable encryption where flipping one bit causes the entire message to garble. Oh, you're not randomly flipping bits. You're flipping bits with a purpose, right? So let's say the message contains a dollar amount, right? And you know in the structure of the message that where the dollar amount is, then you could flip bits there and change the dollar amount. Or if it contains an account number, right? If I know that Alice is paying Bob some amount and there's an account number field, I can flip it and cause it to pay to someone else. You would if you knew what the original number was. You might not know the entire message, but you might know the amount, or you might know a piece, or it might be enough just to change it to some higher number, right? Like I might not know what, say I get you to pay me a dollar, and in the wire transfer message, I flip the 2 to the 31 bit in the message, right? Then right? Then suddenly you're paying me a lot of money, even though I don't know what most of the message is. Okay, so what about this Mac we're using? Any change Eve makes the transcript is going to cause the Mac to fail, right? And she'll be detected. So how does she get away with changing it? So we need Eve to be able to calculate the correct Mac tag, right? We need the transcript to be able to be alterable with the right Mac. Wait, what are you, nuts? The whole point of the Mac is that Bob can be assured that Alice is the one who sent the message and that it hasn't been modified. But in order for Eve to calculate the correct Mac, she needs the Mac key for the message, and then she can forge messages. So, wait. But here's the key idea. Bob only needs to be assured of the authenticity of the message at the time he receives it. Once he's received the message and understands that and is assured of the fact that Alice is the one that sent it, doesn't matter if Eve can modify the transcript and change the Mac. So we publish the Mac keys. Okay? Remember that the Mac key is the hash of the encryption key, and the encryption key changes regularly, roughly every message. So this means the Mac key also changes roughly every message. So once Bob changes the Mac key and forgets the corresponding encryption key, he publishes the Mac key by including it just in the header of the next message he sends out. Right? So he was assured at the time Alice sent the message that the message was accurate. But as soon as he sends his next message out and the Mac key is in it, anyone in the world can change that previous message and recalculate the Mac correctly. What's that? Anyone that's watching the internet. Yeah. Right. And this MAC key isn't part of the encrypted or authenticated message. It's just tacked onto the front. And, yeah, so shortly after Bob receives a message from Alice, he's trivially able to alter the transcript as well. So, just quickly putting it together, we combine these techniques, perfect forward secrecy, message authentication codes, malleable encryption, to produce what we call the off-the-record messaging protocol. We have a simple implementation of this protocol as a library. It just basically takes text messages in and produces encrypted ASCII armored text out, which we've hooked into the game instant message client. The GUI really sucks, but if someone is good at GUIs, come talk to me or Nikita. Nikita will be here during DEF CON. So conclusions. Traditional public key cryptography like PGP works great when nothing goes wrong. But keys can be stolen. Person you're talking to could be a snitch. Things go wrong all the time. We really have to use other techniques to mitigate the harm of a compromise. Techniques, perfect forward secrecy, repudiability. More information, this URL right now, there's a preprint of a paper up there. The source code isn't up there yet, but will be shortly, hopefully after we get some prettier GUI in it. So the question is, how do you ensure the key is forgotten? The answer is, it's pretty hard. Make sure it never touches disk, right? You never ever want this key to touch disk or swap or anything like this, right? So most OSs have some mlock-like command. Some OSs it doesn't work, but whatever. This is an engineering problem. I'm going to punt this problem to the engineers. Yeah, it's not that tough. There is an issue of, well, what about those people who say that if I steal your computer and dunk it in liquid nitrogen, I can read out the information that was in RAM. I mean, at some point, you've got to give up, right? But, yeah. So the question is there a vulnerability regarding the bootstrap? And the bootstrap is just your standard signed Diffie-Hellman. It's an extremely well-understood protocol. No, the question is, if Carl owns you at the moment of bootstrap, will he be able to do anything special? If he can trick your computer into telling you that these messages are coming from Alice when they're not, I mean, as long as he's owning your computer, then he can make your computer say anything he wants. Right? He can make your computer say that Bill Clinton sent George W. Bush a message saying, I love you and want to be your slave, right? But but it's not true, at least as far as I know. Okay, seems we're out of time. Thank you very much.